This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
I hope we don't have war. I hope this can be done peacefully. It's up to Saddam Hussein, however, to make that choice. I also want to remind you that should we have to use troops, should it become a necessity in order to disarm him, the United States, with friends, will move swiftly, with force, to do the job.
President Bush speaking Friday just after the United Nations Security Council passed a resolution requiring that Iraq submit to weapons inspections. The vote was unanimous. Also this week, votes in midterm elections were counted. Hardly unanimous, but still certainly good for the administration. Dan Shore joins us now. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Scott.
And Dan, this Security Council resolution, after so many months of speculation and debate, requires Saddam Hussein to disarm or else, essentially. Took quite a while for this compromise to be ironed out. How did it come about? What was the deal maker?
Well, first of all, I think it's a big victory for Secretary of State Colin Powell, who managed sometime last August to convince the president that he thought he could pull off a resolution like this. This was probably not very wildly popular with Don Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, who was all ready to go to war. But he worked on it, and he managed to work it out. Having convinced the president that if he succeeded, it'd be great. If he failed, the president would look better for having tried. So during those 8 weeks, what happened was that you began hearing less about regime change and more about disarming Iraq. How he did it in a nutshell was by making small concessions on procedure and wording so he could win on the big substance of the thing. So he agreed to give the Security Council a second look if Saddam Hussein doesn't play ball, but the U.S. retains its freedom of action to use force if and when it decides it has to use force. There have to be these other verbal changes, like serious consequences now instead of all necessary means. That is all U.N. speak. In short, Powell gave a little and got a lot and really succeeded in making diplomacy work.
At the same time, do you foresee Saddam Hussein playing ball, as you put it? Do you see him saying, ah, come on in, good to see you again?
Well, can Saddam admit that he's been lying all these years when he said that he has no weapons of mass destruction? Can he say, yeah, I'm sorry, there's some I didn't think of and survive? Can he afford to let his scientists go outside the country for interviews, which is a key feature of his new resolution? The inspection system itself will be quite different from the old one, where they relied almost entirely on inspectors. Now they're going to rely more on intelligence from the member countries, starting with the United States. For example, American intelligence reportedly has learned that Iraq has hidden about 7,000 gallons of anthrax spores. It believes it knows, generally speaking, where that is. So Hans Blix is going to be told, go out and get it. Our intelligence people have learned it, and you get it. So it's going to be quite different kind of regime.
Maybe we should step back a little. The idea about letting Iraqi scientists be interviewed outside the country is the presumption that if they're in Switzerland, they might be more inclined to say something truthful than
if
they were in Iraq.
Absolutely. Most of the information that we have so far has come from a couple of defectors, including the man who was supposed to be the bomb maker, a scientist. And they figure that to save their own skins, the scientists would be willing to leave the country with their families and say, here it is. And so on. So it opens up some exciting possibilities.
In his remarks, President Bush seemed to be quite careful and explicit about saying that Iraqi generals are going to be held to account for their actions if hostilities break out in the region. What do you think lies behind those statements?
Well, the assumption is that there may well still be a war at the end of all of this. And what President Bush was saying to Iraqi generals was, when Saddam Hussein orders you to march, don't march. Stay in your barracks, and you may save your own skin in doing that. Because if you join in that in the defense, you're just another one. So he presents a great temptation to these generals to say, if they're going to lose anyway, why not sort of turn against them? It's a little bit of psychological warfare.
U.S. elections this week, of course, held just a couple days before the U.N. vote. Democrats were staggered, I think it's safe to say. What happened?
I guess we'll know better if and when the exit poll data are finally assembled. But the tentative answer is that President Bush's barnstorming around the country and his emphasis on fighting terrorism paid off. No, if you take 9/11 and the anthrax scare and the sniper episode and the periodic warnings that come from the FBI about more terrible things to happen, Americans today seem to be more concerned about their physical security than their economic security, which is what the Democrats wanted to make the issue. So President Bush has successfully presented himself as a wartime leader who is ready to wage war against terrorism for them. The Democrats simply had no strategy that could deal with that, and so they lost.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of crisis does this represent for the Democratic Party? Because the totals, obviously, in both the Senate and House, particularly the Senate, are still close. They're hardly devastated.
Well, what kind of a crisis? Maybe the first indication of what kind of crisis is what's happening now among the House Democrats. There's Richard Gephardt, who was a Democratic leader, who jumped on the Bush bandwagon on Iraq and the war powers. He has now stepped down. And so we're going to get Nancy Pelosi, an unashamed liberal from San Francisco yet, who voted against war powers, against the Bush tax package, and she's going to succeed him. You remember that President Clinton invented something called the New Democrats, the more centrist Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what's going to have to happen now is that the Democrats are going to have to reinvent themselves once more, moving more to the left, I think.
In his press conference, President Bush appeared to be actually quite modest about the Republican Party's gains. What do you expect to see from the administration when that lame duck session of Congress begins next week?
Well, the president's very clear about that. He wants to do some of the agenda that hasn't yet been met. In the first place, he wants to get a new department which will take care of terrorism. Then he wants to get terrorism insurance. Notice how the word terrorism keeps creeping up in all the things that he wants to make into his very early priorities. And that's about it. He'll simply get all he can in a couple of weeks, and it's probably not going to be very much.
Last week, you said that Security and Exchange Commission Chairman Harvey Pitt would resign, but you didn't think before Wednesday. Well, mm-hmm. you're off by 3 hours. William Webster, next man to put a signature on a slip and put it under the White House door?
Well, the turmoil in the Security and Exchange Commission is clearly not over. The chief accountant now, Robert Herdman, has now resigned. He seems to be also involved in not having passed on enough information to other members about William Webster, who has now become head of the new Accounting Oversight Board. And the question now is, what does Webster himself do? And my understanding is that he's thinking of that about that very, very seriously. I think the possibility that he himself will leave is still very great.
And finally, Attorney General John Ashcroft determined this week that two counties in Virginia would be the first jurisdictions to prosecute John Allen Muhammad and John Lee Malvo for several killings. I believe the figure is now 19, although, of course, that wouldn't be in those two counties. Why do you think he settled on Virginia first?
Oh, it's simple, because Attorney General Ashcroft said Virginia provides the best possibility of getting the death penalty. This is all about the death penalty. Maryland argued that it had more of the victims than anybody else, about 11 of them killed and wounded, but that didn't seem to count. And finally, in the end, they said, Virginia, we know you're going to be able to execute him. Go to it.
Thanks very much, Dan Shore.